You're listening to The Hawk 101.5 FM in Hamilton, Ontario.
You're listening to a show called Dangerfield on 101.5 FM The Hawk out of Hamilton, Ontario. I'm Mary, and tonight my guest is Anna Ruddick. Anna Ruddick is a Canadian musician and bass player. She's a graduate of McGill University's Jazz Performance Program and an attendee of the Banff Center for the Arts International Workshop in Jazz and Creative Music. In her years performing, she has risen to become one of the most in-demand and versatile bassists in Canada. In her career, Anna has performed on more than 45 albums spanning across many genres. And in addition to her session work, Anna has performed live with a who's who of Canadian and international artists. Recently, she was the touring bassist for the acclaimed singer, songwriter, and performer Dallas Green, known as City in Color. She's been a musical director for Canadian pop star Fifi Dobson, as well as a member of the Canadian rock icon Ian Blurton's band Future Now. So welcome to the show, Anna.
Hi, how are you?
Great. So thanks for joining me tonight. I look forward to chatting for the next hour about all things music, everything from your live playing to your recording to everything in between. So maybe let's start off the show with a live performance of yours. So you and I first met when you were playing in Bri Webb's band.
Yeah.
And so the first time I think we met was when you played at an outdoor garden show, and it was in Toronto, and
I remember this show because we had made the record, but I hadn't played like a lot of shows with Bri yet, and I had strep throat for that show, and it was at the Royal Botanical Gardens in the summertime, and it was like really beautiful outside, and I was freezing cold from my fever.
Well, again, so you ended up playing on his acclaimed studio album, Free Will, and
I think that was out before that we made the record. Was the first time that I played with him was in the studio.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no way. Yeah, and then you went on to play that amazing show, and you recorded an album from it, and it was called Live at Massey Hall.
Yeah, that's right.
And you played upright bass on all the time playing with him, correct?
I initially did, yeah. On the recordings, it's always upright bass. We ended up touring quite a bit, and towards the end, I think we were doing like a more electric version of the set because we wanted to like rock out a little bit. But yeah, it was mostly upright at the beginning stages. Sometimes we would bring the electric bass for convenience at the end. Is more what I meant to say, but yeah.
Right. Well, why don't we let's play Low Life off of Live at Massey Hall.
Yeah.
It's a really beautiful song, and it features your bass playing quite well. So for those just joining, you're listening to an interview with Anna Ruddick, and this is her performing upright bass with Bri Webb and the Providers off the album Live at Massey Hall.
They got nothing on you except age. You're worth your wage, aren't you? Oh, that feast of famine, son was your sister, something for nothing. Where in danger you going? Have I done for knowing? But I love you, you deserve better. I wanna cut their tether from you. Thank you.
That was Low Life by Bri Webb and the Providers off the album Live at Massey Hall, and you're listening to Dangerfield on 101.5 FM The Hawk. My guest tonight is Anna Ruddick, who played on that. So Anna, you are quite a versatile bassist, and so when did you start playing bass? What age were you when you started?
I started kind of in high school. I went into a high school that had a pretty extensive music program, and they needed somebody to play in like the jazz band, like the stage band. And I learned, I don't know, 15 years old or something like that. Sometime in the middle of high school, I picked up the electric bass, but I sort of switched to the upright around, I think it was about 16, like grade 11. And I really loved it. There was like a band room, and I found one like in the band room and started kind of messing around on it. And I just really loved playing it right away. So I took it home and just practiced a lot and kind of figured it out and took some lessons with an orchestral bass player and joined a youth orchestra, which was my kind of first foray into figuring out how to play it properly. And I really loved that. It was really great to learn that way.
And at what point did you kind of, so you then went to McGill and you studied jazz performance. Was there like a crossover? For most that know you now, they know you from playing in rock bands or something like that. At what point did you start kind of crossing over between jazz and other genres?
That's a really good question. After school was kind of ending, or I wish I had a better memory of the actual timeline of things. I remember like getting an electric bass when I was quite old, like 24 years old or something like that. And I kind of learned, I remember like the first kind of serious rock and roll band I was in, this bass player, Mishka Stein, who plays with like Patrick Watson and bands like that. He's from Montreal. He was in this band called Shot While Hunting, which was kind of like a prog rock band. And he was like, do you want to play in this band? I can't play in them anymore, 'cause like this other band I'm in is blowing up. So I learned his playing off of the record and like joined this band. And it was a really amazing experience. They were really good. And I like, you know, they taught me how to like play rock and roll music really well. And it was an amazing experience. Learning his bass lines kind of like was a really good foundation too. He's really good.
And so do you keep in touch with anyone from that jazz program? And like, what have other people kind of that you study with gone on to do?
From the jazz program? Yeah, I do keep in touch with some people from the jazz. Like, I keep in touch with some people that I went to, like, I went to, like, the Banff Center with more, which was, like, this supplementary kind of program I did right around when I graduated, which is it's an international like 3 or 4 week program out of the Banff Center where you meet all these people from all over the world and like create music. It's very creative. It's a jazz program, but it's really immersive. And that was like kind of more valuable than my whole university experience combined. It's funny. I met some like more long-term comrades from there than I did from university. But I think I have a couple of friends still that I went to jazz school with. But again, like I didn't really keep it up with jazz. I really tried to transition to learning other types of music really quickly after that. So I didn't play jazz anymore. I really like leaned into the other stuff. And like, that was where I really found my, you know, found what I was really good at recording.
Yeah, when you were in Montreal, you then went on to join an all-female band called Ladies of the Canyon, and you were signed to Warner and put out 2 records, Haunted Woman in 2010 and Diamond Heart in 2013. And that band was nominated for Canadian Country Music Association Award, and then you went on to, in 2014, you actually did a tour with the Bare Naked Ladies, which I recall because that was your first tour bus tour, I remember.
It was my first tour. I forgot, Ladies of the Canyon, that probably would have been the first non-jazz thing I did.
Yeah.
I was friends with the other women in that band, and like they were singers, and I was getting them to start a band, and like that turned into like an actual band. It's so off of the what I do now, that kind of new country thing that I forget. But right. Yeah, totally. Yeah, that was for our second record, we opened for Bare Naked Ladies. That was the first tour bus tour. I was like, we couldn't afford like a tour manager. So I got with this other tour manager or another couple people and like learned how to do the job and like got this tour bus and like had to do all
what was it
like,
called again? It had a name, I think.
It was like, called Gypsy Wind, and Gypsy Wind was like the company, I think, and the bus driver's name was Brad, and it's hilarious because when I toured with Randy Bachman, it was the same like bus and the same driver as
you're right.
Before. Yeah. Hilarious. And that was awesome. I really loved the driver, Brad. He was super funny. So I did too. Like I did a lot of time on that one bus. It was kind of shitty. Like, it was amazing. The one like Dallas got or something. It was like a van. No, it was good.
And so kind of along the lines of, you know, so with the music industry being, you know, quite a male-dominated industry. You did something in February 2019, which was super cool. So you took part in a tour called The Longest Road Show, and on it, it was organized by Tara Lightfoot, phenomenal female singer. And can you talk a little bit about what that was like? I read that there was, it was a completely female tour, and from the performers to the crew.
Okay. So I'm so glad that you brought that up because I totally like, it's so weird. Like now that the COVID has happened, a lot of the things that like I did right before that or the past couple of years, like it's kind of this jumbled thing in my mind. They seem so far away, but the Longest Road Tour was this amazing thing that Tara put together. It was like Tara and me and Lindy Ortega and Bigonia. That's Alexa, Dirks and And the drummer is this woman, Michelle Joseph, who I've played with a bunch, and she's really awesome. And Kelsey McNulty, who's an incredibly talented keyboard player. They're all amazing. Like, and that was the core. And then we toured around to a number of different cities and played like pretty big venues. Like, it was really well received. Like, we sold like the Phoenix in Toronto and stuff like that. And had like several different guests, female performers in each city. Like, we had, you know, Hannah Georges was in London, and we had Melissa McClellan, which is one of my favorite ones, was in, she was in a couple of the different ones, and it's Kathleen Edwards. And we had this really good friend of mine, Karen Weigold, was our sound woman. She drove our van. The van like would break down in the middle of the night. And my daughter was like 9 months old during the tour, and she was with us. Like, it was so old school and amazing. And it was like just the craziest conditions. We would always drive right after the show and like stay in motels and then like play these big shows. It was really amazing. And I'd never experienced a tour before where it was all women, and it was like by far the most fun I've ever had on tour. Like, you know me, I very much pick and choose who I would actually tour with. It's not like the biggest part of my job, but this was incredible. And I really hope we do it again. It was so amazing. And you know, and I've worked with some of those people since then, like, you know, that I hadn't worked with before, and like I stayed friends with every single woman that was on that tour. Like, it was really amazing. So
that's incredible. Yeah. So for those just joining, you're listening to Anna Reddick on Dangerfield tonight. You can find her online at annareddick.com or on Instagram at instagram.com/AnnaReddick. And it's Reddick spelled R-U-D-D-I-C-K. So Anna, you just mentioned that you had your 9-month-old daughter on tour with you. And I think that...
My mom was there too, which was awesome. I can't remember. My mom had to come on tour with me like a bunch in the first year of my daughter Lenny's life. But that one was, she loved that tour. It was madness, but it was really cool.
And so you were quite an inspiration, I think, for a lot of women in general, not only just women in rock and roll, but kind of documenting your process of being not only pregnant, but being a new mother in the Canadian music scene, or even in the international music scene. And so, like, what kind of response, like, I recall you would post about some of your experiences. I remember you playing, like, I saw you at the Horseshoe, maybe was it with Future Now, and you were like 8 months pregnant playing bass or something like that.
I recorded the first Future Now record like when I was like 8 months pregnant, and we started rehearsing with Future Now like after Lenny was born. She was like when she was like a newborn, and
and so
I'd have to like go breastfeed her like during rehearsal and come back and stuff like that. But no, I did play the Horseshoe when I was 9 months pregnant with Paul Reddick.
Paul Reddick it was. Okay, right.
Yeah, I played at midnight, and I was like, look at the pictures, and it's like, it's like you can't tell I'm pregnant in the photos. I just look like I just had like eaten like 40 burgers a day for 6 months. Like, they're the funniest pictures I've ever seen. I love them. They're one of my favorite like show photos.
And what kind of response would you get from women? Like, I recall some of your, you know, Facebook posts and stuff. Like, there was a lot of conversations happening about your experiences. Like, what was some of the kind of key takeaways or memories that you have of that time and some of those conversations?
I remember feeling like, especially when I was pregnant and I was playing a lot, I remember I was on tour for like a month, and I'd come home and I played on like 10 records or something like while I was pregnant. And like, you know, I remember like Lowell Campbell and I driving from like Montreal to like out in Kendall to make another record. Like, we were two back to back in the middle of the night, being like, we have to stop and get like food or whatever. I was really consumed by what I was experiencing. And like, I don't know, like, it's hard for me to say like what the conversation was around it. I just remember like feeling so motivated when I was pregnant. Like, I've always been motivated. I had a good career, but it was like, it got better at that point. Cause I don't know, I had this like inherent like need to just work as hard as possible, because I think like, nothing motivates you like a child. And it never occurred to me that what I was doing was weird, or different, and unusual. But in retrospect, I suppose like people must have been like, I can't believe she's doing that while And then I had Lenny, and then I would like go on tour with her and like figure it out. And I don't know. It was just some of the best times of my life musically were like when she was with me, I guess. Like, I don't know. It was always really great. And I'm sure that a lot of women just felt like, okay, I can do this too. Because like, it wasn't, I know that a lot of people historically haven't done what I did, but it was totally doable. And just that energy that comes from wanting to prove that you're the best, you want to be the best version of yourself for this person you're bringing into the world. That's like the person you care about the most. And it was really invigorating, and it made me feel so much more connected to music and things like that, that I was doing that with her.
And did you not, I think you recorded with Aaron Costello when you were pregnant. Right?
Yeah. I was recording with Aaron Costello, and we were doing Amelia Kern, who's an amazing singer-songwriter, but she's also a film producer now. She was making a documentary about the film, and we were both pregnant. Like, I think she was 8 months and I was 7 months, and it was just like, oh, it was the best. It was so fun.
Why don't we listen to a song? You played on a song called Lights Down Low, and it's off Aaron Costello's album, Sweet Marie. So why don't we listen to that, and then we'll come back and we'll chat a little bit more, okay?
Yeah, sounds good.
Lights Down Low by Aaron Costello, off the album Sweet Marie. You're listening to Dangerfield on 101.5 FM The Hawk. I'm Mary, and tonight my guest is Anna Ruddick. Anna played bass on that song that we just heard. So before we went to the song, we were talking about how Anna had done some recording with Aaron Costello when when Anna was, when you were like 7 months pregnant. And so your daughter, Lani, so she had all this musical kind of a experience in the womb, I guess, like.
So much, constantly. Yeah. I was worried. Like, I remember I asked my midwife around, cause I was playing with, who was I playing with where Ian Blurton was in the band? Cause I know Future Now wasn't happening then. It was with Aaron Goldstein's band, Espanola, and with Kate Bootsman's band, and Kate's band's like all the same people. And I remember asking my midwife, like, Ian and Aaron Goldstein are like the loudest guitar players in the world. And like, I was like, how many dBs can like the baby have in the womb before it goes like deaf? And
yeah.
She was like, I don't know. I've never been asked that before, but she's the only one. And yeah, so it was like,
does your daughter connect with music a lot? Like, what's her connection with music like now?
I don't know. She doesn't seem super musical, to be honest. She is still a bit funny about it because, like, the last bunch of touring I did, I wasn't able to bring her. Like, that wasn't the deal. And, like, I was leaving a lot for many weeks at a time. And so she sort of, like, has this association that, like, she doesn't remember all the fun times from when she was a baby and I brought her along. She remembers me leaving now because that's right. The most recent touring I did. I didn't take her with me. And I was gone quite a bit with City in Color. So right. I think she's still a little bit, like, associating mommy going to work and music with, like, mommy being gone. But, like, it won't be long before she doesn't remember that. And, you know, she likes music, but she's not, like, super musical, I don't think, at this point.
And so you mentioned then just now doing a tour with City in Color. And so that that was a different kind of echelon of playing because you were playing arenas, right, for most of that?
Yeah.
And so what was that kind of transition like? Because you've kind of now experienced, like, every different level of touring possible. What was that like playing for crowds that big? Like, did you feel more of a, like, is there more of a connection in the mass of people you're playing for? Or is it, do you feel the connection or what's that like?
I don't really know. It's different, you know, like that, like the thing about being like a sideman is I'm not playing, like I'm playing someone else's music and I connect to it only in that, like, I like playing it and I think it's good, but like, I don't know what the crowd is feeling. These are longtime fans of somebody that I kind of have only, they're known their music as long as I've been working for them. So I really love, my experience with the connecting to it is more just seeing the connection that the Dallas's fans like maybe had to him. Mm-hmm. And just, it was beautiful to see that, you know, I really loved seeing that, but like, it's more of a, like an executing a job kind of feeling. I don't know. It's different than like, it's difficult to explain. It feels so long ago too, but I love playing those big shows and like, I love the production value and I love Dallas's music. Like, he's so good. I love his guitar playing and I love his singing and I love singing with him and it was just great, but I kind of just sort of like was playing with them on the stage and like was just more enjoying like how good everything sounded. I don't know.
And how do you
it's about perfecting something with that kind of gig, like making sure it's really perfect.
And how is your hearing? Have you done any damage to your ears on stage? Or do you take care of them? Or like what's your process for that?
yeah, it's funny. On the last tour, I was like, all these guys in City in Color were like getting these like $2,000 in-ear kind of rigs and stuff like that. And I'm like, just like turning my monitor.
So earplugs.
Yeah. I didn't even wear earplugs or anything. I definitely like, my partner says that he's like, you're deaf. Like we have to turn the movie up so loud. Like, I think it's normal, but apparently it's like really loud. I have like subtitles on. For sure, but I don't have the ringing yet. But yeah, I think it's safe to say that like I've played with some pretty like heavy guitar players. I remember even with Randy Bachman, like I was so excited to be touring with him, and he'd have like a plexiglass over his amp. He had like two Supros or whatever, and like, but there'd be like an opening like, right next to me where like all the sound is coming out at me. And that's when I was like, I think I'm starting to notice something with my hearing, but like, I don't even care. This is awesome. Like, I'm so excited.
So there's a couple of things. So Randy Bachman put out an album in 2015, and it was his first album that he put out in 5 years, and it was called Heavy Blues. And So apparently the story behind that is, I guess he was at like the Music Hall of Fame induction in Nashville and was talking to Neil Young about putting out a new album. And I guess the story goes, Neil said, do yourself a favor, get a new producer, get a new band, write new songs, do something totally different. And so Randy Bachman said, Randy Bachman said that, he said, I found a drummer who plays like The Who and a bass player that plays like The Who. Randy Bachman said he found a wild drummer who plays like The Who's Keith Moon and a bass player that really plays like The Who's John Entwistle. And knowing you, I know that Entwistle's your favorite bass player. And so that's quite the compliment.
Yeah, I'm not even a big Who fan, but like John Entwistle's like kind of my favorite bass player. The drummer for that like project, like he didn't get a new band, like his band are amazing. I know those guys, like he made this heavy blues record with like it was a side kind of project thing.
Yeah.
We were definitely not replacing his band he's had for like 30 years or whatever, but yeah, like, so he literally got the drummer from like, I think he went to go see like the Tommy musical, like literally like was like, the drummer's amazing, it sounds like Keith Moon, and hired her. And then, I don't remember how I got the gig. I think it was because Julian Peckham maybe recommended me for it. He was booking this band, The Beauties, that I played with, and like, which was like a kind of same blues rock kind of band. So he recommended me from that.
And you've got a pretty famous 90s. It's this beautiful bass that you play, a 76 Rickenbacker. And was that not a gift from Randy?
Yeah, it was a gift from Randy. It's, that bass is like my pride and joy, you know, like I'm playing bass is obviously like something that I've always connected with. It's been my career for so long, but I remember getting that bass, like it felt different. It was kind of like, oh, I get why people like love this one guitar they have the most. Cause like, and that was kind of the one for me. And I remember because it had like this weird pickup situation on it and I had nowhere to put my thumb and it took me so long to figure out how to have any ability to play this thing quickly and so on, but it was worth it because just the sound of it was so perfect. And I've never put it down since, except for the past 10 months of COVID when I have not been playing the bass.
And I remember we were at his show, because Anna doesn't have her license, so I used to be your driver often. and so what show were we at? And then he like carved his name into the...
You're laughing. You haven't even told the story.
What?
I'm already laughing and you haven't even told the story.
Yeah, like, it was like, were we St. Catharines or something? And then he like, didn't he carve his name into, what was it?
Yeah.
With like a nail?
Yeah, with a wine opener. I think we were kind of drunk and it was like the last show of the cycle for the heavy blues record. Randy, it was like, this was our last show that we were going to play unless we did something in the future, which... I mean, hopefully we will at some point. I'm sure we will. But I was like, oh man, you should like carve your name into the back of this bass. Cause I'm like, I'm never going to sell this thing. Like it's at least it's on the back. Like you won't see it. So he sort of like wrote Randy and then it was really hard. It's really old wood. Like he couldn't really get it to happen. And then he wrote like Randy B and it looked like a child's writing. So shitty. And like, I don't know. And we just left it.
Awesome.
We finished the Bachman, but it's you can't even tell what it says, like,
right?
It's the best.
And so you've also like, speaking of kind of, you know, legends, you were also in Andy Kim's band, right, for a little bit, or did you?
Yeah, I did play with Andy Kim with like, I don't remember when it was. It was like it wasn't too long ago. We did like he did like a record like with Kevin with Kevin Drew, and we played like some of his like original music. It was super weird. Like most of the shows were like the old hit songs, like
Sugar.
Like, what are the other ones? But
and so for those that don't know, or I'm sure most people know Andy Kim, but he co-wrote Sugar in 68. You know, it was number one for 4 weeks, record of the year for 1969. And he's got a lot of massive hits. And and so I think I saw you with him. Where was that? Like, was it Niagara Falls or something like that?
Yeah.
So did you get any advice kind of from the older generations at all? Did they impart any wisdom on you that you can think of? Or was it more just like any playing with anyone, right?
from playing with those guys? Like, Randy, for sure. Like, I'm still friends with Randy. Like, I email him once in a while. I loved, like, his perspective on things. He had, like, a really funny, like, way of categorizing his knowledge in his mind. And it kind of made me, like, think about, like, how things come from other things, if that's a good explanation. Mm-hmm. Like, everything is influenced by something else. And, like, I don't know. He had a really cool way of thinking about music and about where it fits into the world and about where different like styles of music fit together and things like that. Andy Kim, I don't know about parting advice on it.
Yeah. And so for those just joining, you're listening to Dangerfield on 101.5 FM The Hawk. And my guest tonight is Anna Reddick, Canadian bass player. And so Anna, since COVID has happened, so you've actually been doing some work with Unison Fund. For those that don't know, yeah. Unison Fund, it's a nonprofit registered charity, and it provides counseling and emergency relief services to the Canadian music community. What's that experience been like for you so far?
It's been great. I love like what the Unison Fund does so much. I never applied to Unison. I've been lucky not to have to because I play bass and there's gigs and stuff like that. I'm so glad. But like, I mean, I know how this is the way the music industry kind of works is like, you'll be like just fine for like 6 months and have like enough money to pay your rent and have everything going on. But it's very, very, anybody, especially side players or it's anyone really in this industry can suddenly have nothing and like no gigs will come in and it's nothing they did. It's very, very hit and miss. It's a huge gamble to be in this industry. And the Unison Fund has found a really amazing way to kind of pick up the pieces of those situations and help musicians that are in a bind and pay some of their bills and pay some of their rent and when they just can't do it. And there's all kinds of reasons why that might happen, whether it's illness or loss or just, you know, suddenly there's no work coming in and things like that. So it's amazing that they exist and they get funding and they're able to help musicians because it's such a beautiful thing what they do. And I've been taking postgraduate studies in arts administration. So I contacted them because I needed to do a placement, like an internship with, mm-hmm. With Humber. And they took me on. And I love working for them and it's really great. And I hope to continue doing it because I'm really passionate about it and I just love what they do and it helps people and musicians work so, so hard for so little. And you know, it's sometimes they need help and I'm so glad it's there to help them, especially during COVID.
Yeah. And so since COVID has happened, have you, Paul Reddick, who you play with, so not Reddick, so it's Anna Reddick, R-U-D-D-I-C-K. And then you also play with a guy named Paul Reddick, R-E-D-D-I-C-K. And he's a Juno Award winner. And you guys did some shows, correct? Out on the East End.
It's been nice since COVID started. Like there's been these like little periods of time in which like there's been the opportunity to play a gig. Like it gets taken away pretty quickly. Yeah. But I remember there was a club down on King Street that we played, the Wee Chief. We played a couple gigs there. I was playing there with this other blues guy, Steve Mariner. And I was able to play a few gigs with Paul Reddick too, whether it was like online and, you know, those guys like that band are like some of my best friends and we always find occasion to play together even when there's we have to play behind a piece of plastic or whatever. But
yeah, yeah, so what was my favorite that?
Yeah.
So, did that impact the sound at all, like for you guys playing, or was it like just kind of like a visual barrier? Like did it impact the sound for you or
I don't know. Like we were so excited to play together that we would have played like in a garbage bag, like it didn't matter. I think it was okay. We were playing this place Sauce in the Danforth, which is a super cool little club. And we would like the first few times we did it, it was, I forget the timeline. It was in the summer. Like there was people in there watching us and then eventually they weren't able to be in there, but they would put a TV outside or whatever. But yeah, that's kind of the only, we've did that three or four times and that's kind of the only live playing I've done. And a very, very long time.
And have you done any studio work since like during COVID? Obviously during the less lockdown parts, but yeah.
Yeah, there was some and I had some sessions that were I had some sessions with Aaron Goldstein, again, the producer. You've done an interview with him. And I was going to be working on the third feature in our record with Ian, but we had to cancel all that stuff. So anything I did have actually did end up getting canceled this year. So.
So you did a cool thing with Ian Blurton's feature now. I think it was it last year where you guys went out west and you recorded an album there?
We recorded an album at the National Music Center in Calgary, which is a really amazing not-for-profit it's a music arts organization, art service organization. That does they have a huge library of musical artifacts, like vintage instruments. They had the big display of Geddy Lee's bass collection. They also have this incredible state of the art studio. They have a venue downstairs, the King Eddie, and they have the recording mobile recording rig of the Rolling Stones, the van with the recording rig in it, which is what we recorded the Future Now record. They do artist residency programs. I'm trying to describe what the National Music Center is. I called it an arts organization, but anyway, it's amazing. It's an amazing place. I remember when I was touring with Randy, actually, we were in Cleveland and we picked up his American Woman, Les Paul guitar because from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, because we were bringing it to the National Music Center, because National Music Center is kind of working up to being the Canada's version of that kind of thing. So we brought it up there and dropped it off, and we actually played it the opening of the construction site. And it was really cool to go back there and make a record. And we used a lot of Randy's guitars on it.
That's awesome.
So it was really cool to come full circle. I love that place so much. They're going to do such amazing things there. And Calgary's such a cool city. And I just think the music scene there is great. And the festivals that festival Sled Island they have there is amazing. And yeah, Calgary rocks. It's great. I want to go back there and play all the time.
And what's your favorite venue in Canada to play, would you say?
Oh, maybe geez, I don't know. That's a tough question. I'd have to think about it for a second. Yeah. My favorite venue in Canada. Maybe it's the Townhouse in Sudbury. Maybe that's it. I don't know. It's probably the Horseshoe. I mean, I'm pretty happy every time I play there. It's probably Massey Hall. I'm pretty happy every time I play there too. I don't know.
Yeah. So since I've known you, you've gone on some pretty extensive tours. So what's the longest tour that you ever went on?
Oh, it would have been touring. It was either touring Europe with Daniel Romano. No, I don't think, because I think his tour was 7 weeks. I think when I toured Europe with Ben Kaplan, it was 9 weeks. And then I did another tour after it with someone else for 2 weeks at the end. So I was gone for the better part of 3 months, I guess. Mm-hmm.
And do you have any desire to tour that long again, or are you is that phase of your life kind of done? You think?
Life is completely over. Don't call me. Don't call me.
Oh, right. I want more children. I came and met you on that. That was the tour that I came and met you in Salzburg.
That was the most fun I've ever had in my life. Was when you and Sharon came to visit me. Mary and her sister visited me in Salzburg, Austria, and we ate Italian food and drank white wine. And for tourists, the most irritating tourists for 2-3 days, the band dropped me off there. And we took the train to Vienna. It was just so great.
That was really fun.
I was at the point on that tour of I don't want to see these people that I'm with anymore. I don't like the songs anymore. And you guys came made me feel a lot better. What is my life? What am I doing? How did I wake up in this dystopia? I love
that. So for those joining, we're talking with Anna Reddick tonight on Dangerfield on 101.5 FM The Hawk. Anna's a Canadian bass player. So Anna, do you have a favorite live performance that you've ever done?
Yeah, it was definitely live at Massey Hall with Bri Webb for sure. Right. That's the best. I don't know. That was the best. It was
and
really
so
great.
When you listen,
there was the I think the concert I played with, I really love the concert, the last concert we did in Toronto with Dallas. I love that concert too. Mm-hmm. But what is it called? The Scotiabank Arena. I'm like, oh, right. Yes, that one. Yeah, that was really fun. I love that show actually too. But yeah, the Broadway Web show for sure. Like, no questions asked. Like, that was the best one.
And that's filmed as well. So for those that want to see it, that was filmed by Massey Hall, and you can watch that online. You can also check out Anna's Spotify playlist of a lot of the music that she's played on her website, annaredick.com. And you can follow her on Instagram, instagram.com/annaredick. And so what's the farthest gig you've ever played? Did you not go play like in the South Pacific sometime? Was that, am I imagining that?
I have actually played some I have. I played in the Seychelles Islands once, which was very, very difficult to get to, but like the most beautiful place I've ever been. I played in the North Pole at the Alert Military Base.
I didn't know that.
Who did you do that with? I played there with a bunch of musicians from Montreal. There was this like program the military had. I honestly don't remember what the deal was.
The North Pole.
Yeah, literally the North Pole. I played a gig there. Like, I was there to play a gig. It was great. I loved that, actually. It was minus 80.
Was it dark? Because it's dark there for like half the year, right?
It was dark there 24/7, like pitch dark. And we were stuck there for a while too because of the weather. Like I think we were there for 10 days. Like we were supposed to go there for like a couple of days and like play and get out.
Right.
But we were there for quite a long time because we were unable to leave. But yeah, it was like pretty awesome experience. And I played in China. I did a tour in China with a band called the psychedelic rock band called Final Flash from Montreal, like in 2009. Yeah.
And what was that experience like?
it was really amazing. One of my best friends, Max Hebert, who's a drummer, it was his band. And it was so much fun. We just had the best time. We smoked so many cigarettes, drank so many beer because water was more expensive than beer. You can smoke in the library. This is so amazing. Like, it was just like it was the Wild West. It was incredible. And like, couldn't figure out how to get food. Like, it was just such a different place, but it was so beautiful. And the people were so nice. And like people hearing rock music that had never like really come out to a show before. Like every show was like that. So it was really, really cool.
And how was that gig set up? Was that through like the government or was that through just connections?
It was through something called Transmit China, which was like a cultural exchange.
Okay.
I think basically out of Vancouver, but I don't remember the details. So I'm not going to pretend it. It was awesome. Yeah. I loved going there. I would like to go back there. I'm sure it would look completely different now. It's a very quickly, rapidly changing place, despite all the ancient things that are there as well. But yeah.
You're listening to Dangerfield on 101.5 FM The Hawk, and my guest tonight is Anna Reddick. So Anna, I'm curious how you listen to music. So do you put music on to kind of like accompany the mood that you're in, or can you take me through a little bit of like when you're at home, like what do you listen to and what kind of determines what kind of music you play?
Well, it's interesting. Like, my relationship to music is so different because it's no longer my job just because of what's happened, right, in the world. And for such a long time, which is interesting, like, the music that I would play would be, like, something I was learning for, like, a gig or something pertaining to something, like, to do with my job. Like, I'm learning this kind of – how to play this kind of thing, or I'm studying this kind of thing, or I'm literally learning – four records of this person I have to do a tour with or whatever the case may be. And it was funny. I was telling my partner Judd, like at the beginning of COVID, like, I can't believe like I'm just like listening to music for the enjoyment of it. Like, I haven't done that in 10 years. Mm-hmm. And we started listening to a lot of like, he never really checked out jazz that much. And so like, we started listening to like a bunch of like, oh, we're going to listen to like every Bill Evans record. And like, we started just like checking stuff out together, and he was playing me a lot of like old blues stuff and really like active listening. And we've really continued doing that like the whole time, which is really nice. And it's definitely really cool to just like enjoy music as a fan, because I have the COVID, that's the only kind of good thing that's come of it for me.
That's great.
Like revisiting that relationship that I had no recollection of because it had been so long, where I just like, you know, and I'm sitting at my computer working, and I'm listening to all these new people's music through my job, and I'll find something I like and I'll end up listening to four of some person's record and that applied for a grant or whatever. And it's like really cool.
And when you hear music, do you pick out like the instrumentation first, or do you hear it all at the same time? Do you listen to the lyrics first, or how do you process it?
I don't really know. I do listen to a lot of jazz, a lot of piano trio right now still, a lot of instrumental music. I think a lot of the time listening to tones and rhythm and things like that. If there's vocals on it or lyrics, like I tend to sort of gravitate towards that first. I like to listen to things multiple times and revisit them and specifically listen to different parts. Yeah. And you know, depending genre wise, like my ear will certainly go towards the bass immediately from that like instinctual thing of like, I have to remember right. what, right? 'Cause I may have to do it myself after. But yeah, I don't know. I think I'm just like listening like a normal person now, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Anna, so the first song on your Spotify playlist that's on your website, annaruddick.com, it's a song called Dollar Dreams from Maze on Scene. Can you talk a little bit about this song and the artist that you're playing with?
Yeah. Women from Winnipeg. Their band is called Mise en Scene. I was called by their producer, who's Eric Ratz, who's a great Canadian producer, who does lots of bands that you know of. And he said, can you come like do this record with these girls? And I didn't know anything about it. I kind of heard their demos and went in, and I was just blown away. Like, I think they're so good, and I think like everyone should hear them. And I love playing on their record. I like did the whole thing in a couple of days. Like I was so jazzed by their music. I was just like, I'll give you three different takes and like played all this crazy shit. I was so excited. Like, I just love them. I think their songs are so good. And I can't remember when that was. Not too long ago, I guess, maybe like, I don't know, a year ago.
Let's listen to song called Dollar Dreams by the artist Mise en Scene.
Okay. Yeah.
was Dollar Dreams by the band Mise en Scene off the album Winnipeg, California. And that was Anna Reddick playing bass on that song. And then now we're coming up on time, Anna. That went by fast. So Anna, thanks so much for being a guest on the show tonight. It was so great to chat with you and catch up. For those that want to check out more of Anna's music, you can go to annareddick.com or instagram.com/annareddick. So thanks so much, and I hope you have a good night, and we'll talk soon, okay?
You, Mary. Thank you so much.
So let's close out the show with you on bass playing a song called Nothing Left to Lose off of Ian Blurton's album, Signals Through the Flames. Good night.